funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We hear it over and over again. Happy, functional families eat dinner together as often as possible. The idea is that meals are the perfect time for connecting, sharing, and simply enjoying one another's company. But if every meal you sit down to with your children turns into a battle of wills, with mom and dad pleading or ordering kids to eat what's good for them and kids refusing anything but white bread and goldfish crackers, or worse, refusing to eat anything at all, family meals can become a time everybody dreads. So why is it that some kids are happy to try just about anything set in front of them, while others view all but a short list of foods with disdain or even fear? And what are you supposed to do about it if your child isn't taking in enough of the nutrients she needs to grow and develop normally? Jenny McLaughlin is a speech-language pathologist at UT Dallas who specializes in evaluating and treating children with feeding disorders. Her new book, written with Dr. Katya Rowell, is called Helping Your Child with Extreme Picky Eating, a step-by-step guide for overcoming selective eating, food aversion, and feeding disorders. Jenny, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What counts as extreme picky eating?
So our definition is pretty broad, but it definitely encompasses anything that's affecting a child's social, emotional, or physical development. Also, in addition to that, if it's affecting a family's just well-being, if there's extreme conflict in the family around mealtimes, that can be really challenging for families as a whole. And so anything that's really affecting all of those areas or one of those areas significantly can be considered extreme picky eating. And we use that term to encompass a lot of other things because there's not a good label that everyone agrees on when it comes to these kids. But there's definitely a very much of a normal bell curve, if you will, of the way kids approach eating. And so some kids are going to be extremely adventurous and risk takers and eat everything like you said, and other kids are going to be really cautious and are going to have a really hard time eating anything and for various reasons.
Some of what you deal with in the book is kids who have developmental issues. We won't talk as much about that during this conversation, but there are other children who, because of just aversion to certain foods, they put themselves at risk for malnutrition.
Sure, and you know, something that we come up against a lot is parental worry and just the agony that parents go through about their child's nutrition. And he's not going to grow, the way he's supposed to, or he's not going to be nourished. And how does that affect his brain and all of those things? And that's definitely a huge concern and probably the biggest worry for parents. And when we come up against that, so many issues come out of that. When a child is not eating a good variety of foods, parents get nervous and they push and they ask kids to eat things that they don't necessarily want to eat because it's good for them, you know. So it's definitely nutrition is a big part of eating, but it's not the whole picture.
And as you point out, you know, there's always like your neighbor or your sister-in-law who, you know, will look at the five foods that your child will at least eat and talk about how bad they are. It sounds like here some of what you're doing, in addition to reminding parents to maybe stop pushing, is saying you have to pick your battles.
Yeah, there are definitely things that parents can do. And one of the first things we tell parents is it's not your fault. It's not your fault that your child doesn't eat well. And social media is so in our faces about everyone's, you know, every child who's eating, you know, their kale smoothie or their, you know, my child eating sushi or things like that. And so for the parent whose child does only eat five things or only eats carbs or, you know, eats one fruit or doesn't eat vegetables at all, it can be really traumatizing for a family and getting that judgment from friends and relatives and doctors to feel like I'm not doing a good job as a parent can be really difficult for families. And I think there's so much to be said for what a family can do. And that's what our book is about, is even though it's not your fault, that doesn't help. You know, it doesn't help to know it's not your fault. You need to feel like you can do something about it. And the steps that we provide families with, I think, have a big impact on them feeling confident as a parent that they can do things that are going to support the child's eating rather than hinder their child's development.
So maybe before they have looked for professional help, a lot of parents do the like one bite rule, or they say if you just eat your broccoli, then you can have a brownie. It turns out that the bribery thing really can be counterproductive.
Yes, it's very interesting because that's what our society does, you know, and it's everybody does it. It's so ingrained in how we think about feeding kids. And actually, the research shows that the opposite is true for teaching kids to like foods. It actually has the opposite effect. There was an interesting study that was done in 1992 that showed that when you bribe with dessert, the children learn to like the food less that you're bribing them to eat, and they like the dessert more, you know, so it's counterproductive. So in the long run, the kids are not learning to like the food. They're just eating it to get through it, to get to the food we've put on a very high pedestal.
Could it work the other way? Could you say, if you just finish that ice cream sundae, I'll
right.
give you a salad?
You know, it's interesting. My son, I heard someone actually say that to him, and it was about lima beans. He wanted more lima beans, and someone said, if you eat this, then you can have more lima beans. And I thought, that's just crazy. But I'm sure it could happen that way.
So one of the things you talk about here is the division of responsibility. It's the parent's job to decide what will be eaten, when it'll be eaten, and where. But the child has responsibilities and, I guess, rights as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's about it all boils down to bodily autonomy, you know, and having control over your own body and what goes into your body. And we all want that. And I discuss with parents all the time, what is a picture of food that you absolutely despise? You know, what is that food for you? Because everybody has at least one that they don't like. And picture it on your plate every meal. And I say to you, you have to eat that. You have to eat it before you eat anything else. How does that make you feel? Does it make you anxious? Does it make you just not want to eat anything else? Does it gross you out? You know, how does it make you feel? And do you feel violated? You know, and it's about the respect at mealtime and teaching children that it's okay to say no. And there's actually been some nice discussion and articles written about, you know, teaching your kids that it's okay to say no at the dinner table translates into them being able to say no to some pretty, you know, more difficult decisions later. And so I think that division of responsibility helps families clearly delineate where is my job and where is the child's job. And the child's job is to decide what they eat from what's available on the table and how much. And so when we allow that to happen, it really frees up the family to engage in those conversations that are really important for, you know, all of those benefits that the studies talk about as far as family dinner. Because if family dinner is a really negative space to be in, those benefits probably aren't very strong.
Why is there value to serving things in what's called family style, where you put the bowls or the serving dishes on the table and let everybody take as much as they want or leave as much as they don't want?
Sure. You know, pre-plating is kind of the opposite of that. So when you serve your child a plate of food that you want them to eat and you put it in front of them, there's automatically this expectation that you're going to eat this, right? This is the food that you're going to eat. When you just put the food in front of the child and put it in a bowl in front of them and allow them to pass the food, to see the food, that neutral exposure to the food has a huge impact on the child's familiarity with it, which has been shown in multiple studies to increase curiosity and tries, you know. So the child is much more likely to try food if they've seen the food. But if it's on their plate in front of them, there's all this pressure to eat it. And so they're much more likely to take that first right of refusal and be like, nope, don't want it. Don't want this, you know, rather than if it's on the table for 10 minutes and then they go, what is that, Mom? And then you tell them what it is and they go, oh, I think I'd like some. And then they put it on their plate. Or if they're extremely picky and they're having a really hard time with food, just the act of passing the food, smelling the food, and watching the other adults enjoy the food can be hugely important for them and help them, you know, become curious. And that exploration and curiosity is such a big part of kids learning to enjoy food. You know, so much of what we think about as adults is, you know, oh, well, I like this food, you should like it too. Well, we've had a lifetime of experiences around food, right? So we've gotten all this time to really get used to what these foods are, learn about them, eat them maybe by ourselves when no one is judging us about it. And kids are very neophobic, so very afraid of new things, especially when it comes to food. And that's been shown across the board. And so when we respect that and allow them to sneak up on food and kind of see it for a while, that really helps them learn to enjoy the foods their family's eating.
So I think people may hear this and say, okay, take your point that they're allowed to decide if they want to eat at all and how much, and people are there with you that far. What if they eat almost nothing and then, you know, this always happens. You've just finished washing the dishes after mm-hmm. dinner and they come in and say, hey, can I have a banana and a cookie?
Sure. So part of this whole approach is that you always serve something you know the child likes. So a side dish. So, you know, like my son who's six is very selective. I always have something, one or two items on the table that I know he'll eat. A bowl of fruit, bread on the side, rice on the side, tortillas, something that I know he can fill up on without any pressure to eat any of the other foods. And understanding that it's not about eat this or don't get anything. That's mm-hmm. not what it is. It's about nurturing your child, but allowing them to eat from what's available with that conscientious effort on your part to serve something that you know is a safe food, that you know that they like. And so, you know, then they're free. They're free to choose from what's available. And they come to the table and they see something. Okay, I know I can eat that. They come and they sit and there's no anxiety. And they're not going to be like, I don't want to come. I don't want to sit down. I don't like that. I don't like that. Rather, they can just sit down and serve themselves and not say another word.
But if you've done that, when the meal is over, the meal is over?
The meal is over, yeah. Then that's the parent's job, the win, right? The win is the parent's job. So if dinner is over and then the child says, I'm still hungry, that's a lesson for that child to understand, okay, I didn't eat enough. The caveat to that is providing what we call a rescue snack, or Ellen Satter deemed, you know, a rescue snack. And that can be an hour and a half after dinner, but it's planned. It's the parent's job to decide the when. So it's happening 30 minutes before bedtime, or it's happening, you know, whenever you feel like it's going to work in your schedule. But it's also your job to decide the what. So if the kid comes in asking for a banana and a cookie, you know, if you understand that, you know, a banana and a cookie, it's not that big a deal if you give them the banana and the cookie. But it's more about you saying, we are having a snack in an hour and a half. We're having a snack at this time. And, you know, and then you decide what's going to be in that snack. And a banana may be a part of it. You know, it's up to you to decide. And every child's different in how they, if they're, you know, really being manipulative, or if they're old enough and mature enough to kind of help you make those choices. It's up to the parent to figure out where that line is.
What about grazing throughout the day? Because some kids might never be hungry at meals because snacks kind of they last a long time.
Yeah. Snacking all day and grazing is an appetite killer, you know. So if you don't come to the table a little bit hungry, what, you know, why do you want to eat the new foods? There's no real reason for you to want to try new foods. And we always say, you know, hunger is the best cook, or hunger is the best sauce. You know, that's a saying that goes around. And it is, you know, when kids are grazing throughout the day and there's just a little bit in their tummy, and that goes for milk, juice, you know, just a bite of crackers or two, something that just curbs their hunger just a little bit. They come to the table and they're not probably going to eat to fullness as much as they would if they were hungry. I mean, you've seen the kid, they're just ravenous after, you know, a day of soccer or whatever, and they just inhale their food. You know, this is the idea that they're going to eat the amount that they should eat for their body if they are tuned in to those hunger signals. So if they're grazing all day long, they're not feeling that satiety and then emptiness, satiety, then emptiness, and that real cycle that we need to go through to kind of regulate our intake.
We're speaking this hour with Jenny McLaughlin. She's a speech-language pathologist at the University of Texas at Dallas, who specializes in evaluating and treating children with feeding disorders. Her new book is called Helping Your Child with Extreme Picky Eating, a step-by-step guide for overcoming selective eating, food aversion, and feeding disorders. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Jenny McLaughlin of the University of Texas at Dallas, whose new book is called Helping Your Child with Extreme Picky Eating, a step-by-step guide for overcoming selective eating, food aversion, and feeding disorders. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Is this a problem, Jenny, of families in situations that are food secure? Like, is anybody who is regularly worried that they just won't get any food at all susceptible to things like food aversions?
Yeah. And so you've got all these issues coming together, right? Mm-hmm. So I've worked with a lot of families who are not food secure, who have a child that has a severe feeding disorders fed through a tube, for instance, because of a medical issue. And food security is such a huge issue in our country and, you know, just around the world. And I think when families don't know that they're going to have enough food on the table, it makes things really difficult when you have a child that, you know, doesn't eat the food that you've got. It definitely can come into play. And I think that there's so much about just kind of middle-class society where families have enough to, you know, put food on the table and can provide a good amount of variety for their families, that it's frustrating when food goes to waste. Especially frustrating if you're struggling to just put food on the table. And so, you know, so much of what we discuss with families is that it doesn't matter so much about what is going on the table. It matters about being there with your child and the how of feeding your family versus the what. You start with what you're already eating and you just put it on the table and you allow your child to choose from that. And then you move on from there and can, you know, kind of strategically look at what kinds of foods that you want to include in your family's diet. And, and for children that need a registered dietitian to look at their intake, that's always a really good decision for families to make because they can see what, if any, micronutrients or macronutrients, you know, are missing from the child's diet, and then kind of focus on those and try to include those more and find ways to prepare foods that are more supportive of what the child's, what we call feeding temperament, is geared toward. So if the child is very kind of a sensory seeker, which is what we kind of call them in the field, is they're looking for lots of crunch, they're looking for lots of flavor, they're trying to get lots of experience in their mouth, they're not going to really like the bland foods, the soft foods, the things that are just don't give you a lot of input. Or if your child is just extremely visually not okay with things touching, or if something looks slightly different, they have a fit, you know, that is a really difficult problem for families too. And so trying to include foods at the family table and make an effort to support the child in ways that help them where they are is really important. And for families to understand where their child is, I think that's one of the biggest things to start with.
You talk about building bridges from foods that kids do eat to foods that they haven't tried. And sometimes the bridge doesn't even seem like a bridge to us. Like if your child is eating spaghetti, you can introduce bow tie pasta, which is, you know, fundamentally the exact same food, mm-hmm. but may help the child understand that they might like something other than what they've had before.
Because mm-hmm. so much of their issue is about how it looks. Mm-hmm. You know, it looks different, therefore it is different. And so giving them a cognitive bridge, you know, this is spaghetti bow tie shape, you know. And I had an experience one time with my son, and he really liked this teriyaki sauce that was on the rice at a restaurant. And I said, oh, well, you know, the chicken has the same sauce on it. And he said, oh, it does? And I said, yeah. And so he took a bite of it, and he really liked it. And from then on, he ate that chicken. But he would not have even touched it if I hadn't given him that cognitive bridge. And the thing is, there's no pressure in that statement. I'm giving him a matter-of-fact statement. That sauce is the same as this sauce. Period. You know, there's no judgment. You'll like it. There's no, just try a bite, you know, because that shuts them down and that makes them go, oh, I don't want it.
For some families, taking the pressure off, it might lead temporarily to the kid eating very little at all or only eating, you know, saltines dipped in ranch dressing, which can be a little scary. And you write about, you know, you might be 2 days in and think, forget it, this is not working.
Yeah.
Talk us through what we do in those situations.
Yeah, it's really hard for parents. It's kind of like jumping off a cliff for some families, especially if they've been doing it that way for a long time and kind of, you know, pushing and pushing for a long time and don't feel like, you know, and a lot of times families tell us, like, I know that this is not going well. I just don't know how to get out of this. You know, I don't know how to do something different. And so it's kind of taking a leap of faith, you know, and I've had, you know, umpteen families come and tell me, and after I've kind of guided them through the process, you know, over a couple of months, they're like, I'm just free. I can't believe, you know, how much better my life is because I'm not worried about what the child is eating. And what happens is, you know, it's all about trust. So when the child doesn't trust the parent to let them have autonomy and let them have some control about what goes in their mouth, they're going to test the waters at first, you know, and they may only eat their very safe foods for a few days until they trust that the parent isn't going to make them eat what else is on the table. And for a little bit older kids, we tell families to say, I'm not going to make you eat it. You know, I'm not going to make you eat it. You don't have to eat it if you don't want to. I know I used to, but you don't have to anymore. And that's pretty powerful for kids, you know, to feel that way. And for families to take progress, not by what the child is eating, but the attitude at the table is really important. And that's what changes first is I come to the table. I'm happy to be here. The smiles start returning. They can have a conversation and they don't look dejected the entire time they're sitting there. That's the changes that we see right off the bat after just a couple of days. And then children start eating more of their safe foods, and then they start eating maybe one other thing that's similar to their safe foods, and then they can start branching out because you can't be free until, you know, to try other things until you feel safe. You know, I've listened to an NPR talk, a TED speaker a while ago, and he was talking about trust. And he said, you have to feel safe before you can trust. And I thought that was really powerful because if you're looking at the food and it looks like poison to you, you don't feel safe. And so then you can't trust what everybody's telling you. So I thought that was really an interesting way to look at food because, you know, we all want to feel safe.
Speaking of trust, and you write about this in the book, there are now all these cookbooks that teach you how to, like, grind up a whole zucchini and stir it into a chocolate chip cookie batch. Mm-hmm. You say proceed with caution.
Yeah, and we feel like there's nothing, you know, inherently wrong with adding nutrition to foods your child's already eating, as long as your child is, you know, aware of the fact or that they're not bothered by it. Because, again, some kids are so anxious about their foods remaining the same that any slight change can be detected, you know, from a mile away. You know, oh, I see something different. It looks just slightly different, or it smells different, or they take one bite and they're done. And so then you might have ruined a safe food, right? Mm. So it's a very, you know, it's a big balancing act for families. And I think, you know, with the range of kids, you know, some kids are totally fine with that kind of approach and it doesn't really affect them. But some kids are super anxious about food. And when we do that, it can really undermine the trust that we may have already built. And so like with my kiddos, you know, I let them grind it up and they can see what's going in the muffin, right? So or, you know, we talk about, you know, there's carrots in the spaghetti sauce or whatever it is, but that they understand that that's what's in it, because then they can learn that, oh, maybe I like carrots, you know, because it's in there and I liked it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak on the phone to Charles in Plano. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Chris. Great show. I wanted to say that I agree with most of what Ms. McLaughlin is saying. I mean, the vast majority of it, I think, is great. And this is something that I've thought about a lot since I've had my two kids. I think that I wanted to add two points. One is about it not being the parent's fault. I think it absolutely is the parent's fault if you've got a picky eater. And I think it's understandable. I think that as a society, we're much more oriented towards making adults feel okay about whatever it is they decide to do, and what's best for the children is pretty much secondary. And I think the way that it starts is very simple. You know, you prepare a nice meal for the kids. They say that they don't want to eat it. They're being picky. And it's just easier to get them macaroni and cheese or a hamburger or grilled cheese sandwich or whatever. Well, you do that once, and it's all over. I mean, dogs can manipulate their owners very, very well. Kids certainly can, and if they know that that's an option, that's all it takes.
What do you think, Jenny?
You know, I think a lot of people would agree with you, and there's definitely a lot of things on the internet and people writing, articles on Huffington Post and things around that they don't really understand what a true picky eater looks like, the kids that I see day to day. I have many families who have 3, 4, 5 children, and they've fed their children all the same way, and that fourth child doesn't eat. So, you know, when you look at they're feeding them all the same way, they've done the exact same thing, and they're still doing the exact same thing, and this child still doesn't eat. It's not about the parents anymore, you know. It's about that child and his feeding temperament and what he brings to the table. And I think so much of what we think about kids is, you know, they're their own little people. Like, they're not just, you know, what we create. It's the nature-nurture issue, right? So there's definitely some nature that's involved in this. And I think, in my own family, I have 3 children, and 2 of them are very adventurous eaters, and 1 is extremely non-adventurous and has high anxiety about food. And I fed them exactly the same way from day one. So in my own family, and I do this for a living, and I wrote a book about it, but it still is in my home, you know, where I have to really be conscientious about not pressuring, and I'm not catering. I don't cater. I don't just go make macaroni and cheese if he doesn't like what's on the table. We talk about there are things on the table that you can eat if you're still hungry, but I always have something that I know he can fill up on so that he doesn't come to the table and think there's nothing here for me to eat. You know, it's not about jumping up and short order cooking. And I've had so many families that when they stop short order cooking, things change for the other kids in their family, kids that are fairly good eaters, but, you know, have fallen into the trap you're talking about. But moving to this kind of approach, it helps the whole family, the siblings of the picky eaters as well. But, you know, I don't agree with you that our parents are causing these issues, because if you talk to the families that are really struggling with this, and I'm talking about these are not typical picky eaters. These are kids that don't eat. They eat 3 to 4 things. It's not their fault. They've done everything that anybody has asked them to do, and it's still not working.
When you sit down with these children, if they're old enough to articulate it at all, what do they tell you about why they don't want to eat things? Because I'm sure they see their parents and their friends enjoying foods that they do not enjoy. What do they say about that?
You know, they say they're scared, you know, that it makes their tummy hurt just thinking about it. They've got a lot of anxiety. It all boils down to that butterflies in your stomach, there's no room for food, you know, and that's kind of how I tell parents. Like, if you feel nervous about a food that's sat in front of you or that your parents are eating and just looks odd to you, and we go back to that neophobia. Kids are neophobic. They do not, you know that it's going to be good just because you tell them, right? So it goes back to, you think it's kind of this primal protective thing, you know, back when, you know, if we were hunters and gatherers, you know, you do not eat something if you don't know what it is, right? And so kids start this about, you know, 16 to 18 months, they start showing these signs of pickiness, and it's kind of universal where they were eating everything and the parents say, oh my gosh, she used to eat everything and now she won't eat it. And it, you know, and if we push and pressure, it gets worse. If we don't, they come back to those foods eventually. They all do. But if we push and pressure and make it a battle about it, then they draw the line in the sand and they say, no thanks.
And it turns out pressure also takes the form of saying, oh, I'm so proud of you for eating your whole bowl of Cheerios. Like, that's a form of pressure.
Yeah. And it's sometimes, you know, it will feel to the child like they are going to disappoint you if they can't do it tomorrow. You know, so if mom is really proud of me and I'm a good girl because I ate my carrot today, I'm not a good girl tomorrow if I just can't bring myself to eat it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Nancy in Denton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A friend of my son's 5 years ago watched a classmate choke to death at school. And he, ever since then, he's been incredibly picky. And he very skinny for his age. And I wonder if it's a trauma of that. I mean, in a way, it's an obvious answer to me, but what do you know about that?
Oh, definitely. We talk about that in the book as well. And It's likened to PTSD, you know, when you observe something that is so emotionally traumatic, and he's equating eating with dying, you know, in that instance, you know, and it's hard for children to make sense of that emotionally. And so it can absolutely have a huge effect on, you know, how he views food and his trust with food. You know, he doesn't trust that every time he eats, he's not going to choke. You know, and for kids that have had other kinds of traumatic events, I mean, I've had kids who have choked, and then that spurs an entire, you know, picky eating or just really difficulty with eating later. Kids that, you know, have been force-fed, and that is really traumatic for them. It causes gagging. It causes, you know, gagging until they vomit pretty much because they are so emotionally wrapped up in that traumatic sensation and that anxiety that goes with trauma. And kids don't know how to cope with that. And I would really encourage that family to seek out counseling outside of food, not talking about food, but talking about his feelings around that situation and helping him with that anxiety that he feels about seeing his friend die, because that's where it has to start.
Some parents might think, okay, if my child eats only chicken nuggets and Kraft macaroni and cheese, and, you know, whatever, I stop buying chicken nuggets and Kraft macaroni and cheese. Does that work?
It depends on the kid. Mm-hmm. You know, if the kid is really easygoing and, you know, not an extreme picky eater like we have described, they may go with it. But for kids that, you know, they literally can't see that they're the same thing, you know, they buy the, you know, more healthy version of the chicken nuggets or whatever, you may have to do it a lot more gradually. Not that you can't move them over to something else, but it's allowing them, like we talked about those bridges, allowing them to experience that some foods are very similar and that they can go from this food to that food and maybe enjoy that food as well, and then kind of work those out of the rotation. But if those are the only two foods that the child eats and you just take them away, that's kind of cruel. You know, I mean, that kid is going to come to the table and they're going to leave the table hungry.
We're speaking this hour with Jenny McLaughlin. She's a speech-language pathologist at the University of Texas at Dallas. She specializes in evaluating and treating children with feeding disorders. She's co-author of a new book called Helping Your Child with Extreme Picky Eating, a step-by-step guide for overcoming selective eating, food aversion, and feeding disorders. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jenny McLaughlin. She is co-author of Helping Your Child with Extreme Picky Eating, a step-by-step guide for overcoming selective eating, food aversion, and feeding disorders. We'll go back to the phones now. We have Nancy on the line in Dallas. Hi, Nancy.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a friend whose son is 14 and a half and who's a very easygoing, sweet kid. But ever since he was little, he refused to eat any fruit and all vegetables except broccoli. So he's athletic, but she worries that he's not getting the right nutrition and balance of foods to be healthy. And he's even tall and growing, but she still worries because there's obviously a skewed balance towards, you know, just heavy protein and no fruit and vegetables. So what can you do when you have a child who's almost 15?
No, I think it's never too late because I have a lot of families or a lot of moms who have very picky husbands and use this approach, and it's amazing how things start changing at their table. And I think and again, I've had families where I'm working with the child who's three, but they have teenage siblings. And the family reports to me that, oh, my gosh, my picky 15-year-old asked me what something was that was, you know, in the oven for the first time ever. He's never shown curiosity about what we were cooking. And it just – it was this kind of natural effect of serving family style and not short order cooking, because this family had six children, and they were – literally short order cooking for every single one of them a different food, which was hugely time consuming. But the older child was, you know, but they were also pressuring them to eat what they had cooked, because if you're spending all this time cooking food and then your child doesn't eat it or doesn't eat it fast enough or doesn't eat all of it, then and you're pressuring them to do that, then that's pressure. But, you know, as far as your friend's, you know, nutritional needs, you know, I think it's really important to look at, you know, what do we need nutritionally? I mean, there's a really, you know, there's some really interesting studies by dietitians looking at, you know, every body is different and we all get different amounts of nutrients and things from different foods and absorb nutrients differently. And I think it'd be really helpful if they went and had a nutritional analysis by a dietitian to kind of ease some of those worries, because, you know, broccoli's pretty awesome, you know. So if he is eating broccoli, then that's probably doing pretty well in that regard. But maybe he can drink juice, you know, or maybe there's something else that he could eat that, you know, a vitamin can do a lot too. But I think, you know, as far as that goes, I think looking into finding a, you know, a specialist that can help with that to ease those worries. Because if he is growing well and developing in every other way, then, you know, it may not be as big a deal right now. And it may just take a little time.
I'm sure you've dealt with families where parent A grew up a picky eater and really doesn't want to push, and parent B grew up in a family where you ate what was put in front of you and you didn't complain and you said thank you very much, and there's parental conflict on top of everything else.
All the time. You know, we have that all the time. And, you know, I think everybody has different backgrounds and different ways that they approach food. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a study in 2002 that talked to college students, and they overwhelmingly disliked foods that they were forced to eat as kids. And it's an interesting concept when you talk to parents about, you know, how were you raised and, you know, what kinds of things made you like this food or not like that food. And then when they talk about their spouse and they say, oh, you know, we're having a really hard time with this because I think they should just sit down and eat what we give them, and, you know, she's more permissive or whatever. And I think what we really find helps is to discuss these things together and say, well, you know, why do you feel like they have to eat this before that? Or what's the reasoning behind it? You know, and then you get down to the why, it can really help get you on the same page so that you can work out some of that. But also understanding that if it's really, if you're at odds with each other and it's very, very different, having one person kind of drive the bus for a while and the other person is just there for the ride, that can help. And also sharing progress with each other. So we encourage our families to keep a journal and to write down things on a day-to-day basis, that things are going well, things are not going well, just to really have that to look back at so that you can share progress with the spouse that maybe isn't there all day.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Carver on the line in Fort Worth. Hey, Carver.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I really wanted to talk about my own experience as being a picky eater when I was a child, and it had mostly to do with texture. I was extremely picky about the textures of the foods that I would and would not eat. And if I thought it even looked like it had, say, a crunchy part inside of something that's soft, it would be a no-go for me.
Sure.
Yep.
Yeah, and you know, I think you're not alone. There's a lot of those kids out there, and a lot of adults as well. I've met quite a few adults who are, you know, as they call themselves, closet picky eaters, where they can function and they get along just fine, but definitely have some real kind of serious aversions to food. And I think, you know, the texture issue is the sensory experience of food. You know, when you talk about, you know, the sensory experience of food, there's the visual aspect, there's the smell, the olfactory senses, there's the feeling, the tactile sensation of if you touch the food with your hands or don't touch it. You know, a lot of kids don't touch the food. And then how it feels in your mouth. And the not so obvious thing is that food changes the second you start chewing it or manipulating it in your mouth. And so then it's a different texture. So I think texture is a huge thing for a lot of kids.
We have an email here from Lauren who says her 5.5-year-old daughter is an extremely picky eater. It's affecting her energy, our family, and well-being. She said she was referred to your book by the pediatrician just a few days ago. she says her daughter turned away at a restaurant because of the smell in the restaurant. Can you describe some steps that might help her? And when do you know when it's time for therapy?
So when a kid is that sensitive to smell, you know, I think there's a couple of things you can try. And I think it's at home, you know, creating situation where, you know, we've had families that set up fans so it's blowing the smell out of the eating area, or children that have put bandanas around their nose just so that they're not so overwhelmed by the smell. And I think, you know, smell is so connected to taste. And so for children that have real issues with the way food tastes, I think that they get kind of hypersensitive to the way that food smells. And so, you know, I think with the approach in the book, it's about reading your child's cues. It's about being responsive to them and about, you know, understanding that they're not doing this just to spite you. You know, it's truly something they can't control. And so being responsive and understanding and brainstorming with her. If she's 5.5 and she's able to kind of talk about it, you know, brainstorming with her ways that she might be able to sneak up on smells, you know, and finding smells that she does like, you know, and really kind of exploring that a little bit.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Robin on the line in Dallas. Hi, Robin.
Hello. A question about, you know, you mentioned that it's not the parents' fault when the kids are adverse to certain foods. And I am a mom of several children, ages 22 down to 4. And very often we entertain, have friends over with their kids, and the parents are very frequently shocked at the variety and types of foods that my kids eat. And the one thing that I have noticed that's very common amongst the parents whose kids are extremely picky eaters is that the parents have a very different attitude towards food. And very often, subconsciously, they purvey their dislike of vegetables.
You know, modeling is such a big part of kids learning to eat food. And that's what the family meal is all about, and eating as a group rather than you eating and the kids eating separately, or the kids eating at the, you know, at the island and then you eat later different foods, you know. So kids seeing you eat vegetables and fruits and meat and all the different things. I mean, we need all the things, you know, we need all the foods, is hugely important because that's how they learn. So if a child is never exposed to a trusted adult eating broccoli, how do they know that broccoli is something that they could like too? You know, so you're absolutely right as far as that kind of subconscious, you know, not showing your child that it's safe to eat those things, for sure. And so we really, you know, encourage families to go to a different grocery store, you know, to kind of mix it up a little bit, and or, you know, try a different vegetable, try something that you've never tried before, if that's a goal for you. You know, for some families, that's not a goal yet because they're just worried about, you know, their child not screaming and running away from the table.
There is the ability to make peace at home. Maybe you stop pressure and everybody is going to live with at least making sure that the kid gets enough calories every day. Then there's going to grandma's house, a friend's house, and then the kind of wave of loving judgment starts all over again. How do you teach a child who is dealing with food aversions to be out in the world, because you still want them not to offend people mm-hmm. who are trying to politely serve them something that that child really doesn't want to eat?
Yeah, and this is a big problem, and I think because, you know, people mean well. They don't mean to, you know, push the child or make them feel bad about themselves. But I think there's so much we can do as parents to be advocates for our kids that have these extreme issues, and, you know, and helping them understand you don't have to eat anything that you don't want to. And talking them through it, especially if they're 4, 5, 6, you know, and you say, you know, so-and-so may ask you to try something, and your job is to say no thank you, and that is your job, you know. And if you don't want it, you say no thank you and you move on. You're polite about it. You don't say yuck, you don't say gross, because it's our job as parents to teach manners, mm-hmm. you know, and to help them understand that it's okay for you to say no, but we just say it politely. But it's also our job as parents to tell those other well-meaning adults in their life that, you know what? He's in charge of his eating, and we're okay here, you know? So he doesn't need to eat anything he doesn't want to eat. Our job is to provide the food. You know, think about a buffet. His job is to go to the buffet and choose from what's available, and our job is to provide the buffet, provide the food, and everyone will be happier. And it really does free up everyone from micromanaging.
Schools for a long time have had, you know, nutritional requirements with the lunches and the breakfast they sell there. A lot of schools now say it's our policy that you can't bring X in a sack lunch. And this has been an issue for some of your clients.
Yeah, there's just, you know, there's, I think, so much wrong with the policing of what is in a lunch that's brought from home, because it's the parent's job to pack that lunch. And, you know, if the school absolutely has to have nutritional requirements for the food that they serve from their cafeteria, it's not their job, though, to police what the child brings from home. And there's been some instances where that has happened, and it's been all over the news, you know, where a child had Oreos in her lunch and the teacher held it up in front of the class and said, these are not healthy, and threw them away and then sent a note home. Well, you know, what if that was one of their five accepted foods? And then you've just cut that out for the kid because they're embarrassed and they're not going to eat it because it's not healthy, quote, quote. You know, so it's a very fine line, I think, that we have to really balance out, you know, what is the job of our public education system as far as this goes, you know, and the private schools do it too, and they have more leeway because they're private. But, you know, there's something wrong when we feel like we have to micromanage what a parent is providing for a child. There's another issue. I mean, if the parent is not providing food for the child, or it's only Oreos and that's it, I mean, that may be a totally different problem. But, you know, I think we have to be really careful.
If I know any adults, Jenny, who only eat five foods, they hide it really well. Can we assume that most children will grow out of this? And will they not grow out of it if we don't take appropriate steps to intervene?
I think typically picky eaters, you know, kids that are typically picky, and that's the vast majority of kids hit a time in their life when they are picky, will grow out of it if they're not, you know, made to feel horrible about it. But, you know, there are definitely lots of adults. There's a kind of whole forum online of adults who are very selective about what they eat, and they just don't socialize with meals. So they may just say, I already ate, and then they get by without eating in front of people. Or, you know, they bring something that they know they can eat, which is something we tell people to do. You know, if you're going to a potluck or you're going to a social gathering, bring something you know that you can eat or that your child can eat. That way you solve that problem. You know, so, you know, they're out there. I think, you know, it's hard for them.
And what do you say to your own children who are not picky eaters in your family, where you've got mm-hmm. two that eat really well and one's that's a lot more selective? How do you communicate that it's not special treatment? This is just something you're doing to help brother kind of manage his life.
You know, it's a non-issue. It mm-hmm. really is. I mean, because we've been serving family style and it's not his food or our food, it's dinner.
Yeah.
You know, it's lunch. Everything on the table is for everyone and it's free. You know, everybody can have everything. And so when it's served that way, there's not that division. And I think my older son occasionally will say, why don't you just try it? You would like it if you just try it. And we nip that in the bud pretty fast because I say, you know, he doesn't have to. It's up to him. And maybe someday he will, but it's okay if he doesn't, you know. And we really just try to teach them. We say in the book, don't yuck my yum. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it goes the opposite way too. You know, don't push me, you know. And so for some kids that look up to an older sibling, just the modeling factor of them eating something can be hugely productive. They're watching their older sibling eat it and they're like, oh, well, he said I want to eat it too. Then maybe they eat it off of their plate, which is, you know, kids eat it off of our plate because they trust us. Same thing with siblings. But, you know, we just really try to manage that in a very kind of neutral way.
Jenny McLaughlin is a speech-language pathologist at the University of Texas at Dallas. She specializes in treating children with feeding disorders. Her new book is called Helping Your Child with Extreme Picky Eating, a step-by-step guide for overcoming selective eating, food aversion, and feeding disorders. Jenny, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. We had help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.